Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Margaret Flowers, who explains why she and other advocates of a single-payer healthcare system are urging the Supreme Court to overturn the individual mandate in President Obama's Affordable Care Act. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink and Global Exchange, who talks about the revitalization of the U.S. peace movement now organizing to prevent a new war with Iran. And Representative Earl Blumenauer, Democrat of Oregon, who discusses his efforts to transform bicycling into a political movement and the challenges facing cyclists in the current economic and political climate. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The United Nations announced it reached a major anti-poverty milestone when it met the deadline for cutting in half the number of people across the world without access to clean drinking water. The Clean Water Program is part of the Millennium Development Goals, designed to cut extreme poverty, fight hunger, and improve health outcomes for women and children. From 1990 to 2010, the United Nations Children's Fund and the World Health Organization claimed that over 2 billion people gained access to clean drinking water. That still leaves over 780 million people without access to clean water and nearly 2 billion people without basic sanitation. Much of the progress was made possible by rapid development in China and India. But access to clean drinking water is still a major challenge in much of sub-Saharan Africa, where just 61% of people have access to clean water, compared to over 90% of citizens who live in Latin America, Northern Africa, and Asia. Only 58% of the people in Africa's most populous country, Nigeria, have access to clean water, but it's a major improvement over 1990. However, simply drilling new water wells in poor villages is not enough, as one-third of Nigeria's new wells have been abandoned due to poor maintenance. The nations of Africa that continue to struggle to provide clean drinking water to their people include Angola, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Chad, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Mozambique. Despite the urgent need, only 30% of grants awarded by U.S. private foundations to fund global water and sanitation projects goes directly to African countries. Sadly, overall foundation support for water and sanitation projects in Africa has declined since 2007. Sexual Minorities Uganda, a human rights group, has sued American preacher Scott Lively in a U.S. court, charging that he aided in persecuting gay citizens in Uganda. The complaint filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights seeks damages against Lively. One Ugandan gay activist, Frank Mugisha, told reporters in Springfield, Massachusetts, where the suit was filed, the aim was to hold Lively accountable for his actions in Uganda. The suit was brought under a federal law allowing victims to file civil suits in the United States for alleged violations of international law. According to the BBC, Scott Lively was among American evangelical Christians who visited Uganda shortly before a bill was drafted that called for the death penalty for certain same-sex acts. The bill provoked outrage among donor countries like the United States. Scott Lively, who runs Abiding Truth Ministries, denies he told Ugandan legislators to impose the death penalty for homosexual acts. The preacher told the BBC he advocated for criminalization in the same manner as possession of marijuana or speeding tickets on the highway. Lively dismissed the lawsuit as political theater. However, the complaint alleges that Lively had urged Ugandans to fight against a genocidal and pedophilic gay movement, which he compared to crimes of the Nazis in World War II and the 1989 mass murder of Rwandan civilians. With the shooting death of unarmed 17-year-old Trayvon Martin by an armed Neighborhood Watch volunteer in Sanford, Florida, the national trend of weakening restrictions on issuing concealed handgun licenses and stand-your-ground laws has come under greater scrutiny. Florida was the first state to adopt a concealed carry law in 1987. Now, nearly every state except Illinois allows some form of concealed carry gun license. Mississippi recently allowed gun owners who take an extra safety class to bring a concealed gun onto college campuses and courtrooms. Ohio has granted gun owners the right to carry a concealed weapon into restaurants, bars, and sports arenas. New Hampshire and other states have removed all restrictions on carrying a gun into the state house. Since December, North Carolina has allowed licensed gun owners to carry concealed weapons into public parks. In Tennessee, one out of every 11 adults packs a concealed gun or has a permit for one. The passion for gun rights is driven largely by the National Rifle Association, which tries to instill fear in gun owners that the government will soon be coming to confiscate weapons. The Violence Policy Center, which supports stricter gun laws, says people with concealed carry licenses killed 117 people between 2007 and 2009, including 9 law enforcement officers. The Christian Science Monitor reports that between 2005 and 2009, the number of annual murders committed with a gun dropped from over 10,000 to about 9,000. However, during that same period, the number of defensive homicides rose from 196 to 261. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Zofia Hunter.
The fate of President Obama's Affordable Care Act hangs in the balance as the Supreme Court justices set aside 3 days ending on March 29th to hear arguments from opponents of the controversial health insurance reform law. The justices will hear arguments centered on 4 issues filed in multiple lawsuits by 26 states and other opponents. The first issue is whether the court has jurisdiction to hear the case, given that no one will pay the new law's tax penalty until 2015. The second and most important issue deals with the constitutionality of the law's requirement that all U.S. residents either buy insurance or pay a tax penalty. The third issue focuses on whether the law's expansion of Medicaid unlawfully forces states to participate. And the fourth issue will examine if any part of the health reform law can survive if the individual mandate is struck down. Groups across the U.S., both supporting and opposing the law, have filed a record number of Friend of the Court briefs in the case, while most of the law's opponents offer no alternative policy to cover the estimated 50 million Americans currently without insurance. One group challenging the law does. A group of 50 physicians and 2 nonprofit groups filed a brief urging the court to strike down the individual mandate as unconstitutional. As an alternative, the group advocates instituting a single-payer system to achieve universal health care coverage, as exists in most other industrialized nations in the world. Your reporter spoke with one of the physicians filing the brief, Dr. Margaret Flowers, a Maryland pediatrician who is a congressional fellow with the group Physicians for a National Health Program. She explains why she's opposed to the Affordable Care Act and how a decision by the Supreme Court overturning the law could pave the way for a vastly improved universal health care policy that would exclude for-profit private health insurance companies.
The 50 physicians are all physicians who advocate for a national single-payer health program, as well as the 2 nonprofit groups, Single Payer Action and It's Our Economy, which deals with issues of economic justice, support a single-payer approach. In the United States, we're already spending enough to provide lifelong, quality, comprehensive health care to every person living in our country. And we think that anything short of that is just not acceptable, because the situation that we're in right now leaves out, you know, tens of millions of people. We have tens of thousands of people that die every year unnecessarily because they can't get health care, families that are going bankrupt, businesses that are going out of business, employees that lose their jobs, and it doesn't have to be this way. And the Affordable Care Act is based on flawed policy that will not achieve the goals of universal, affordable, guaranteed health care. And so we wanted to make the point that the individual mandate from a policy standpoint is not good policy, and that we can achieve our goals in this country in a much simpler way.
Supporters of President Obama's Affordable Care Act say that we shouldn't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. It's a phrase I know you hear a lot. And they talk about the good elements of this law in stopping insurance company discrimination against people, particularly for pre-existing conditions, allowing children to stay on their parents' health insurance policies longer. Some good elements there that most Americans like. How do you respond to the idea that, while not perfect, this law may be worth putting in place and it could be built upon to maybe get to a universal single-payer system someday down the road?
Well, it's just a myth to believe that we can take this law, which is very complicated, which further entrenches the insurance companies, gives them, you know, millions, hundreds of millions of public dollars to these for-profit corporations, and think that we can turn that into a health system. We've been given these excuses, and I've heard these, you know, for the whole time that I've been advocating for health reform. You know, we hear these arguments, oh, but this bill does this one good thing or these few good things, and we shouldn't let the, you know, perfect be the enemy of the good. And meanwhile, we're moving backwards when it comes to health care. Our health care costs continue to rise out of control, and the number of uninsured people is growing, people that are dying from preventable causes. So what we're actually doing is we're being sold this idea that, oh, well, we can't oppose this bill because it has a few good things in it. It does a few good things for some people. But meanwhile, we're leaving all the rest of the people out completely. And we have evidence-based solution right here in this country. An improved Medicare for All would control our health care costs and cover every person in this nation. It's favored by the majority of Americans. It's favored by the majority of physicians. But it's opposed by the industries that are profiting off of our current situation. And so we really, at some point, you have to say, this, we're not going to get anywhere if we keep accepting these arguments. And we have to say enough is enough. It's time to join the rest of the industrialized world and create a healthcare system that works for every person.
What do you think the political fallout would be if the Supreme Court overturns the individual mandate and the rest of the law kind of falls apart in terms of the elements that people like? Do you think people would give up on the idea that government should get involved in healthcare and someday support the idea of single payer? Or do you think people would redouble their efforts to get something different than this very complicated Affordable Care Act?
Well, I think what we were hearing right after the Affordable Care Act passed was that, you know, this was kind of a concession. It was not a bill that really addressed our underlying problems, and most people who are honest about health policy recognize that. And what we were hearing, you know, from people like Ezra Klein and the Washington Post and Robert Kuttner were, well, if this doesn't work, then we're going to have to seriously look at creating an improved Medicare for All in this country. And they actually started using that term, Medicare for All, which is something the single-payer movement uses. So, you know, this bill is already falling apart. There have had to be, you know, over 1,000 waivers given to unions and businesses and insurance companies by the Department of Health and Human Services, giving, you know, waivers so that these entities don't have to comply with certain provisions in the law. We just had a Congressional Budget Office report a few weeks ago saying that as a result of this law, 20 million people are estimated to lose their employer-sponsored insurance and be put into the individual market where insurance is more expensive and has skimpier coverage. There are, you know, some children who are allowed to stay on their parents' policies until they're 26, but not all of them. We also know that insurance companies are able to skirt around these issues of pre-existing conditions. They do that by restricting which doctors within their network, by restricting which services are covered. So it's something that's not going to be a solution. And the longer that we wait for a real solution, the more suffering and death there is in this country, and the more our health care costs rise. It makes it very difficult for businesses, especially small businesses, to survive with these high health care costs. It has an effect on families who have to choose between paying for their medication or their treatments and paying for other necessities in life. It's a no-brainer, really, that it's time to just go for a single-payer system.
That was Dr. Margaret Flowers, a Maryland pediatrician, who is a congressional fellow with the group Physicians for a National Health Program and an organizer with Occupy Washington, D.C. Learn more about groups advocating for a single-payer healthcare system by visiting our website at btlonline.org. Since the election of Barack Obama as president in November 2008, the U.S. peace movement has remained mostly inactive. Many peace activists were optimistic or had mixed feelings about then-Senator Obama's campaign pledge to wind down the war in Iraq and his timeline for escalation and then withdrawal in Afghanistan. But in his third year in office, there is a growing number of progressive activists that are either disappointed or angry about a fairly long list of his administration's policies. That list includes the president's increased use of drone attacks, the targeting of U.S. citizens for assassination, support for an indefinite detention of Americans provision in the National Defense Authorization Act, the failure to close down the Guantanamo detention camp in Cuba, and continued warrantless surveillance targeting U.S. citizens. But increased talk about a new U.S. war with Iran over that nation's nuclear program seems to have been a catalyst for awakening important sectors of the peace movement, which otherwise has been in decline. In early March, protests organized by Code Pink and the local Occupy Wall Street movement in Washington, D.C., outside the annual gathering of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, a powerful pro-Israel lobby group. There, activists used signs and giant puppets to send their message opposing a war with Iran to convention speakers that included President Obama, several GOP presidential candidates, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Protests are now being organized to greet some 5,000 delegates to the Chicago NATO Alliance Summit meeting in mid-May, where 50 heads of state will be in attendance. The White House had earlier announced that the G8 summit meeting, originally scheduled for that same week in Chicago, would be moved to the secure presidential retreat at Camp David, Maryland. Your reporter spoke with longtime peace activist Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace and Global Exchange. Interviewed at the late March United National Peace Conference in Stamford, Connecticut, she talks about the revitalization of the U.S. peace movement, now organizing to prevent a new war with Iran.
Well, we're looking to where this is coming from. For example, we were at the big policy conference of the lobby group AIPAC, which has been gunning for this war. And they are so powerful that they sort of force all of the leaders of this country, from Obama to hundreds of members of Congress to the Republican candidates, to come before them and say something about how they're going to make sure that Iran never gets a nuclear weapon and that no options are off the table, and each one trying to outgun the next. So we were there not only protesting, but we were in the halls of Congress when they were in Congress with our own peace force, and took out full-page ad in The Hill the day that they were there saying AIPAC wants a war with Iran, we don't. And we delivered packets to every member of the Armed Services and the Foreign Relations Committees. So we're working on that level. We're also working directly on the grassroots level with women in Israel and Iran. We put out a joint call from the three groups of women saying that we didn't want this war, and that has just taken off. The first call in the U.S. went out in the name of Alice Walker, and then Gloria Steinem did the second one, and it's really just kind of mushrooming now, and a lot of women and men want to get involved in this kind of grassroots people-to-people ties. We're trying to get a delegation to go to Iran and to get the visas to be able to get inside. We think it's important to be promoting now the human ties, showing as citizens what diplomacy looks like, since our government has obviously forgotten what that's all about. So these are some of the things we're doing, and we're looking for other ways to join, like with the Pledge of Resistance, that the groups that are part of United for Peace and Justice are signing, which says that you will, if there is an escalation of anything from sanctions to military intervention, that we pledge that we will put our bodies on the line to resist it. So I think there's a renewal of organizing activities. You know, the anti-war movement has been pretty dormant since Obama got in, but now people are worried about a possibility of another war and starting to get organized.
This being an election year, and as you said, the Republican candidates are putting a lot of pressure on the White House to, you know, take a tougher line in Israel too. Are you concerned that things could spin out of control pretty quickly, even if, let's say, the Obama administration isn't anxious to start a new war, that the priorities of getting reelected could really get him in a place where he would be forced to take some action which, you know, would have unexpected and unforeseen consequences?
they know the consequences would be so catastrophic for a war, and this is just part of that, you know, male testosterone war talk. So I would say 50-50, and 50-50 is a very scary percentage. And given that, I think we've got to mobilize as if it were greater than 50-50 and really do everything we can to stop a war.
Where do you think public opinion is at right now in terms of a war? You know, you see a lot of people in the country, a vast majority of people turning against the war in Afghanistan, which is interesting. Even the Republican candidates are being quiet about that. But where is public opinion about the quote-unquote existential threat that Iran presents to Israel and the United States that we hear so much from the folks, like you said, at AIPAC and a lot of the folks that they support in Congress?
Like all polls, it depends on the wording, and different polls have shown different things. But they do show that most Americans do not want to see another war. They do feel that we should, quote, have Israel's back, because that's really been kind of pounded into them. But they prefer to see diplomacy used rather than war. And I think that the leaders in this country know that, and there's so many people in the military who are saying, no, this would be disastrous, don't get us into a war. So there's a lot of reasons to not go into war. What I see as one of the hopeful things is the grassroots movement that's coming out of Israel right now, with this graphic designer and his wife that started putting out this meme that says that shows pictures of ordinary Israelis saying, we love Iranians, we will not bomb your country. And that has just taken off on Facebook and on the web. And now Iranians have responded saying, we love Israelis, we do not want war. And we as Americans are now entering into that and saying the same thing. We love Iranians, we will not bomb your country.
That was Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace and Global Exchange. She's the author of the forthcoming book, Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Find links to peace groups organizing to prevent a new war with Iran on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The League of American Bicyclists held its annual summit meeting in Washington, D.C. from March 20th to 22nd. The theme of this year's conference was Save Cycling, prompted by House transportation legislation dubbed by former Congressman and current Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood as the worst transportation bill he'd ever seen. House Republicans wanted to zero out funding for bike trails, all bike and pedestrian enhancements, and safe routes to school, spending all the billions in the bill instead on roads and highways. But as the bill stalled in the House, the Senate passed an alternative measure that is much more friendly to cycling than the House version. Though it freezes in place the steady upward trend of funding for bike and pedestrian enhancements, like bike lanes and other amenities that were initiated in 1992 with the Intermodal Surface Transportation Efficiency Act. One of the speakers at this year's National Bike Summit was Congressmember Earl Blumenauer, Democrat of Oregon, who is chair of the House Livable Communities Task Force. He's also the founder of the Congressional Bike Caucus, which with more than 200 members is the largest caucus in Congress, with members from both major parties. In this excerpt of a speech delivered at the Bike Summit, Representative Blumenauer discusses his efforts to make cycling a political movement and reviews some of the challenges facing cyclists in the current economic and political climate.
My goal in working with you these last 12 years in particular is to make cycling a political movement. We've given out tens of thousands of the little bike pins. We've organized the Bike Caucus events. We've worked with people from coast to coast in your communities, being excited about what's happened. We've taken these issues to members of Congress in ways that hopefully they understand. We've worked with you in terms of making these messages louder, more direct, flexing your political muscles. You know, occasionally we've gone after some of the people who, in their wisdom have decided to attack cycling, and we've got their attention. Well, you, being part of this political cycling movement, made a huge difference last month. We were faced with what the Secretary described as the worst transportation bill in history. It was an outrage. And it wasn't just attacking cycling. And you were part of a coalition that stopped it dead in its tracks. They were actually too bashful to actually have a hearing on it. We went right to work session. In Ways and Means, it was my amendment to try and change the funding raid. And while we weren't successful in committee, you made it possible for me to waive a letter signed by over 600 groups and organizations, from Bikes Belong to the U.S. Chamber, unions, environmentalists, pointing out how far out of touch they were and how wrong the policy. And before it could be taken to the floor, it crumbled. It crumbled. And you were a part of that broad coalition. You were at the table with the road gang. The chain gang was there with the other established interests. Listen to, flexing your muscles, making the point. I'm going to leave you, but you need to help us expand our focus. We're not going to turn back on the federal level, and with your help, we will seek to enhance it when people come to their senses around here. But we need to carry it to every city, every county, every school district. Everybody's got to have their bike and pedestrian plan. You don't have to be an Olympic sprinter to get across the street safely. We don't have to waste 60 billion miles a year taking kids back and forth to school. This is something that we need to unleash when we go home, not just once a year at the bike summit on Capitol Hill. We have come a long way in 21 years. Prior to Ice-T, what, $4 million a year? Immediately after that landmark legislation, which would have been undone, we're at $160 million a year for cycling. Then in the last reauthorization, it was for $100 million a year. And with President Obama's Economic Recovery Act, we had 2 years of $1 billion for cycling, for trail, for pedestrian safety. Amazing. And it was transformational. We're not going back.
That was Representative Earl Blumenauer, Democrat of Oregon, speaking at the League of American Cyclists annual conference on March 21st. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Find more information on groups promoting bicycling on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Zelfia Hunter, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.